Sagar and Marshall here. Welcome back to The Realignment. It is my great privilege to bring you today's special guest. That is Crystal Ball, my co-host, my other co-host on Rising over at The Hill. We have a really excellent conversation for you guys today. I'm really excited that Crystal was able to make time and join us today. And we hit basically all of the realignment cues and rising cues and things that we get all of the time. So I know it is going to be of interest to everybody out there.
Sagar is very happy with this episode because now Crystal has to be the one to answer the why should you not make a third party question. So we know you guys have more of those coming. There's no way you're going to be happy with it, but we're going to keep on trying. And speaking of questions, then before we dive into this episode, give us your ratings. We are at 733 ratings on Apple. It helps people find the show, helps people subscribe to the show. And once we get to 1,000 by the election, we will not bring it up again. So take this app that you're listening to this podcast on, scroll to the bottom and rate us 5 stars. And if you want to leave us a question to answer, you can leave us a 5-star review, leave us a question in the actual review, or you could send us a screenshot to realignmentpod@gmail.com. So for today's question, which we should mention was left in the comments section, so that actually does work. The question from Scotty 12456788 is, how much weight do you give to current national polls on Trump versus Biden? Are Trump voters really afraid to answer honestly? And who even responds to polls anymore? What do you think, Sagar?
Great question, Scotty. One that I get all the time. I never thought I'd be a little bit of a polling connoisseur, but hey, that's kind of how life turned out for me. Look, I think it's your right to be skeptical. Is there a shy Trump voting phenomenon? Yes, there's actually a Bloomberg story that recently came out showing that some Trump voters are very skeptical and do not want to answer pollsters saying that they support President Trump. So let's get that out of the way. However, I'm not going to say that polling is perfect if it's gotten better. I'm not going to say it's trash and terrible like some people would have you believe either. I would say it's okay. Here's the couple of criteria that you need to keep in mind about why the polls were so off in 2016. Number one, they did not weight properly for education, as in they overweighted college-educated voters, underweighted non-college-educated voters. By and large, most pollsters after 2016 have corrected for that, and they'll actually release the breakdowns in their polls. So that's one thing you should always look for. Number two is registered voters versus likely voters. Registered voter polls, which almost always, through a couple of statistical analyses that have been done, show a roughly 2% margin increase for Democrats. So if you see a registered voter poll, automatically deduct 2 points from whatever Joe Biden or the Democratic candidate is showing there, and you'll have something around what the true figure is. Now, recent polls are live voter. That's important too. So that's one where somebody actually has to pick up the phone. There's no, you know, automatic stuff. There's no online. It's like actually a human being talking to another human being for a sustained period of time. That live call voter, likely voter, and a properly weighted education poll is exactly what you're looking for. So with all of those criteria involved, Joe Biden is still up by about 5 or 6 points nationally. And that is, you know, that's pretty good. Now, there are a lot of caveats here, which is that at the same time, Trump is doing better with Hispanics. Trump is doing better with Asian Americans. Trump actually could do better amongst significant parts of the Democratic coalition. But he's got two major problems going for him right now, Marshall. That is number one, senior voters. I know a lot of you are like, I never get polled. Well, guess what? Boomers, seniors out there, they pick up their phones. They got a lot of time on their hands and they like to take polls. So number one, we see a large drop off amongst Trump in boomers, largely due to the coronavirus pandemic. They disagree with his handling of the pandemic. And the other one there is the college educated white upper middle class voters. We talk about them here all the time. Huge surge of support there amongst Joe Biden, and not just amongst support, like a flip of Trump to Biden, but people who just straight up didn't vote last time around or would vote for like a Republican Senate candidate sometimes on occasion. A lot of those people are voting for Biden as well. So that is my very long answer to that question. We get it here all the time. It's very important for you as a consumer to understand exactly what you're looking at.
Wow, there's so much there that we actually probably should do a polling show of someone interesting before the election, because I appreciate how detailed you got there. So a couple of things. One, the thing that people should remember about 2016 is Don't forget, Hillary still won the popular vote by 3 million votes. So this actually just shows how complicated the electoral system is, because yes, the polls in 16 didn't really account for how close New Hampshire was. They didn't account for the 70,000 votes in Wisconsin, that there were these sort of voters that came out of nowhere, but there was this broad direction. So this is something that if you're on the right and you're listening to the show, you really should think about, because no matter what, it's pretty plausible that even if Trump pulls off a win, you could see a repeat of 2000, you could see a repeat of 2016, where he loses that popular vote. And something we talk about with Crystal on this show, but so interesting today, is this idea of what is going to happen to the left and to the right if they get an adverse electoral result. So what will happen if Democrats, who are convinced that Trump has all of these huge issues, end up losing the election, but Joe Biden picks up 2, 3 million, 4 million popular votes? On a cultural, social level, I think that's going to be a disaster. I can't imagine what the media or any sort of activist reaction is going to be. But also on a broader level, too, you are going to see Democrats much more interested in things like increasing the number of justices on the Supreme Court. You're going to see much more interest in abolishing the Electoral College. So you need to think about how these things play into a deeper structural factor.
That's right. And with that, let's get to this excellent conversation with Crystal Ball. But right before we go, as always, a thanks to our sponsor, the Lincoln Network, and a reminder that the Reboot Conference is coming up after the election. Sign up at Reboot 2020. Check out some of those panels that are scheduled. I'll be there, Rachel Bovard, many of our friends. Check those out if you're interested. And with that, let's get into it. Ready, Crystal?
Yep.
Crystal Ball, welcome to The Realignment.
It's great to see you guys.
I never get to introduce you, so this is kind of fun.
Well, yeah.
It feels a little weird, I will say. Yeah.
One thing, too, is it's welcome back to The Realignment, because we all last spoke together in February, which on 15 different levels was a totally different world. So that was right when you guys released your book. You were sort of in the middle of Bernie doing really well. There was no pandemic. So it's been a while.
Oh, God. Yeah. I mean, Crystal, I think that's the one thing that we should start off with, which is that obviously we've been doing the show now for months and months and months, but we haven't really had a time to at least publicly process what the hell has happened in the last 7 months and kind of where kind of things stand. How do you think things stand right now, kind of for people who are inclined for our politics and who are populist? Are there things to be hopeful? There's a lot of despair, which we talk a lot about. Just where's your head at currently?
God, it really depends on like the day, the minute, the hour, you know, because look, at the national level, it's just deeply grim. Not only do you have on the political front, you know, Joe Biden, who has gone out of his way to basically not only not give anything to economic populists, but to actively crush that. He doesn't even talk about even some of the things that he supports, like $15 minimum wage. You know, he doesn't even talk about that. It's not something he's running on. I would be shocked if he actually pushed for something like that in his administration. So at the top, it's very grim. We know what type of people he'll put in his administration. We know who he's listening to. We know who he'll go out of his way to screw and to try to crush. And yet there are hopeful political signs as well. You see a sort of grassroots insurgency. You see some new strategies, some new bottom-up strategies that are really bearing fruit. One thing that we talked about, which I think may be actually the most hopeful model for my politics that I've seen, is in Rhode Island, small right. state, where you only need a few thousand votes to win in these primary contests. There was a concerted effort to run a lot of economic populist left candidates who I think ousted eight different incumbents in one night, which will just completely shift the tenor of that state house. And so I think for now, that's probably the more likely direction to pursue. Bernie was kind of a unique one-off type of person who was able to galvanize this national movement without actually having the infrastructure and the bench and the sort of organizational backing to really build that up. There's no one out there who's exactly in the model of like would be his successor clearly and would be ready to go in 2024, or the sort of strategic or organizational model behind them. A lot of the left is engaged in these kind of like internecine battles, which are like deeply destructive and really annoying and all of those things. So I guess that's what I would say. And then, you know, obviously the big picture that we talk about all the time, you guys talk about too, is these just like underlying dynamics of all the trends. Every single one of the trends that brought us Donald Trump and Bernie Sanders has been accelerated, right? This mass inequality, like the deep and obvious unfairness of our economy, the humiliation that's been visited on working people. And meanwhile, you also still have these massive demographic shifts that, you know, that create a sort of turbulent political economy and demographic reality as well. So all of those things have continued and probably been exacerbated during the pandemic. So you have to think that there's some kind of a shift coming. It's just a question of when and how, and is it done through conventional, peaceful political channels or not?
Mm-hmm. Can you speak to, I like the way you frame that, and there's a contradiction in it, because there's been a lot of friends of both the realignment and rising who've been dunking on us for this. They're like, where's your realignment now? Yeah. Biden won the primary. Josh Hawley did X, Y, or Z thing we find disappointing. You know, you're talking about how there are these trends which, you know, we're seeing accelerate that should support populism, who are sort of seeing, even with President Trump, sort of him govern more as an establishment person. So could you speak to this dynamic and sort of why in the short term it seems like the establishment's actually sort of cleaning up?
It's a deep contradiction. And look, part of it is that a lot of working class people are so disenfranchised, so disgusted with the political system that, I mean, we have mass rates of non-voting where people just don't believe that the political system is going to deliver for them. The unrest that you see in the streets, the riots that you see in the streets, is not justifying them, but that's an expression of that same feeling of like these political channels, Obama saying like, don't boo vote. Like we did that shit and it didn't work out. You know, we're still here. You didn't really fundamentally change anything. So it's a really unhealthy kind of a situation for a democracy to find itself in. You know, on the Biden coalition, which is shifted, it's a real realignment, you know, moving the Democratic Party even further in the direction of catering first and foremost to this affluent white suburbanite. You know, this is something they've been chasing for years and years and years. And a candidate like Bernie Sanders was kind of a last-ditch attempt to stop that full movement of the Democratic Party into white affluent suburbanite land, where you cater, those are the people you actually cater to, their interests, and then you keep the black and the brown working class in the tent, at least somewhat. I mean, they're still bleeding Latino voters right now to Donald Trump, but you keep them in the tent somewhat by just saying, well, the Republicans are awful and the Republicans are racist, and Republicans have given them certainly plenty of fodder to be able to do so. And so as long as the working class remains divided along racial or geographic lines, primarily racial, but also geographic lines, then it's the, you know, affluent suburbanites combined with the actual, you know, elites, wealthy elites who rule everything. And that's exactly the dynamic that we have right now.
Right. And Crystal, I think that's one of the things I really want to delve into here, which is that, you know, you have this Biden Republican case, which we've talked about here on the podcast. And we talked about on the show. Rahm Emanuel kind of like saying the quiet part out loud. He's like, no, we should do what Ronald Reagan did. We should bring these like wealthy, elite, suburban people into the coalition and we should govern with them for all time. And frankly, I mean, it kind of makes sense in the short term. Like, it's not a bad strategy to vote. It's within the existing electorate. These people all vote a lot. They have a lot of political interests. The non-voters are just going to continue being non-voters. What's the case against that? Not just for the left, because the left has a political mission, for the Democratic Party politically, because right now, politically, I'm like, hey, okay, you know, seems like a fine bet. Why shouldn't somebody go down that road? What are the risks?
Well, if all you care about is winning elections, it's not a bad strategy. Right. And we see that right now, although even right now in the purely take the values out of it and just like we want to win elections, that's it, end of story. even in that, you see the risks, right? You see Latino support bleeding away. You see a depressed level of enthusiasm among Biden voters. You see young voters, you know, deeply feeling deeply dismayed and disenfranchised and like no one is representing them. And they're, of course, the ones who have been most crushed in the pandemic, most crushed in the financial crisis, most crushed by being sent off to fight and die in, in wars overseas, right? So they're completely disenfranchised and unenthusiastic. And so that's created, that is the risk for Biden right now. If he loses, that is exactly why, because they've done nothing to excite those parts of the Democratic Party coalition that, by the way, were the parts that were the most enthusiastically for Bernie Sanders. So even taking the values out of it, you run a risk by just going all in on the Biden Republican, the John Kasich types. For my you know, political views and the project of building a multiracial working class and the project of having an economy that works for people outside of the top 10% of Americans, it's an utter disaster. And the perfect example, there's actually a perfect contrast here between the way that the Democratic Party is constituted in Virginia, which is now a suburban dominated state, versus Nevada. So in Virginia, this is now a blue state. It's my home state. I've watched this evolution over decades now. Be very hard for a Republican to win at the state level ever again. And Democrats hold both the House and the Senate. So they can do whatever they want, right? They can set the agenda. They can do whatever they want. And they campaigned on things like raising the minimum wage. They campaigned on things like, you know, improving union rights. This has long been a right to work state, quote unquote. But when they got into office, they didn't really do any of that stuff. mostly been obsessed with, like, you know, things that I support. I'm not, you know, claiming that this is nothing or that I don't support it, but it's things like, oh, let's pass the ERA, right? Let's have a new Equality Act that's going to prevent discrimination this or that way. Again, good. Everyone should be equal before the law. No problem there. But the issue is they never get beyond that. They never, it's still the state that is worst in the entire nation, a blue state that is worst in the entire nation in terms of workers' rights. And that is what a suburban politics looks like. Now, some other thinkers will say, you know, even on the left will say, well, look, suburbanites are teaming up with you. If you ask them on economic issues, they're more liberal than the general public. They're more liberal even than Democratic leadership. And that's true. But the problem is, it's not just what do you answer in a poll question, it's what are you gonna fight for? What are you gonna withhold your vote over? What are you gonna go into the streets for? What are you gonna push your politicians to actually do? Because if you're not gonna hold them to account, they're not gonna do anything. They're gonna continue to please their donors. They'll put some progressive window dressing, you know, identity politics type window dressing on top of it. And suburban voters are gonna be totally satisfied with that and comfortable with that, because that doesn't threaten their prospects for their kids. They wanna make sure they get the same life that they have. So that is the danger. Nevada is a different model. Nevada is really, you know, to the extent that it's a blue state, and it is a state that leans blue at this point, that was built through a labor movement. That was built through, you know, the Culinary Workers Union in Las Vegas, very strong, many members. And so that's much more of a sort of multiracial working class coalition based on the service economy there. And so you end up with a different type of politics. And that also expressed itself in the Democratic primary, where the state went so strongly for Bernie Sanders over the objections of a lot of the kind of elite Democratic leaders in the state. So you see the results ultimately end up being incredibly disparate for the reality for working class Americans in the country.
Yeah. So something that's interesting in your sort of earlier point was this acknowledgement that a lot of people just care about winning elections and these sort of ideological debates don't really matter as much. But the sort of thing I want to put forward is, what if winning elections is actually all that matters when we look at the Supreme Court, when we look at the sort of executive level decisions? Because the problem for me is that I sort of look back at what happened with Ralph Nader in 2000. And yes, there can be this debate about whether or not he truly swung Florida or not. But a lot of people, regardless of the actual outcome, were swung by the belief that, like, fundamentally, a Democratic Party that argues we're better than Republicans, or a Republican Party argues that they're better than Democrats, is a bad thing. Well, a bunch of things happened during the Bush years that I definitely do not think would have happened even under sort of like center left to center Al Gore. So how do you think about that dynamic when the courts are up for grabs?
Yeah, I mean, it's a real trap. Like, this is what you're articulating is the conundrum. Just given the structure of democracy, that you really only have the two choices for the two major parties, which is why I've always thought that, yes, third parties can be important for pushing different issues and putting issues on the radar and forcing different parties, forcing the two major parties basically to align more with what those third parties are offering. But ultimately, the game is played out inside of the two major parties. That is the reality of the political landscape. So I think any project of sort of successfully moving the country in one direction or the other, at least through traditional political channels, has to be fought inside of those two parties. It has to be fought through primaries, has to be fought through basically taking over the institutions themselves. And it has worked in the past, mm-hmm. right? In fact, the Democratic Party, as it's constituted now, is the result of basically a sort of takeover by the DLC Democrats, the Clinton DLC Democrats in the 90s. That is the reason that we have the terrible Democratic Party, in my view, that we have today. Donald Trump could have taken over the Republican Party if he kind of like had his act together, had some real ideology that he was willing to fight for, had some institutional backing behind him, like really had any care or concern to actually work on that project. That was all there for him. It's just that it was easier for him to sort of get co-opted by the existing Republican institutions, and ultimately he didn't really care. So that's how he ended up. But that prospect was there. You saw some of it with the Tea Party, right? The Tea Party very effectively pushed the Republican Party hard right on a lot of economic issues in particular. That was a relatively successful outing. And you came very close with Bernie Sanders, ultimately. I mean, you know, it's easy now, especially looking at the final tally, to be like, oh, he didn't even come close. But I mean, he actually really did. Like, he was within a week of things falling completely the other way. And so to me, that's where the game has to ultimately be played, because you're right, Marshall, like, ultimately, you look at the numbers right now, and there isn't a significant vote going to third parties. There are, and I also am not one of these people who doesn't want to pretend like there aren't real differences between the two parties. There absolutely are. So when you're in this lesser two evils dynamic, the only thing you can do is try to fight to change the party that you think is most likely to ultimately represent the interest, not just your interest, but the interest of the working class, which is what ultimately I think we all care about here.
So, Crystal, I want to spend some time on this, because this is what we've spent a lot. And obviously, for Rising, the number one question we get is about third parties. Surprisingly, number one question we get here, also about third parties.
Third party, interesting.
Every single time.
Yeah, every time. It's always third party.
Yeah.
And I've even been like, guys, like, enough. But no. Yeah. I'm not blaming them. I understand where the sentiment comes from. So you made a very critical point there, which is that ultimately, in your view, a third party's most critical, the way that it can best use itself is to force an existing political party in order to a certain action, maybe left or right or center, wherever. So when it matters, when we think about the Bernie campaign or we think about successful party efforts, what matters more? Is it the movement or is it the leadership? Because obviously, the Bernie movement was, you know, it's robust. I've seen it, and you've seen it as well. But because the leaders who were in charge, Sanders himself, as well as, you know, AOC and others, largely decided to play ball with Joe Biden or not try and fight for anything, they made
co-opted
it so that the power that they could have wielded certainly was not wielded. So what matters more? Is it the movement or is it the leadership, or is it a mixture of both?
Gosh, I mean, obviously it's a mixture of both, but I think I have to go with kind of what's ultimately an unpopular answer, given especially the left's like love for the grassroots, which I share and which I'm not going to say isn't important. I just talked about the victory in Rhode Island, which in a lot of ways was a grassroots effort. The Sunrise Movement is having massive impact across the country. Like, those things are real and they really matter, and they're issue and policy driven. But we live in a celebrity culture. And so it used to be this idea, like, all politics is local. all politics is kind of national now. You know, we were just, you were sharing with me, Sagar, some research that basically says candidate quality doesn't really matter that much because people just vote their partisan divide, right? That's a reflection of the fact that politics has become so national. I mean, I saw this in Kentucky and other places where it's played out, where you used to be able to have a separation between like, oh, well, this is a Kentucky Democrat and this is a national Democrat. That's not possible anymore, right? Everybody is like lumped in together. And so in that kind of celebrity culture, with politics really covered in that way too, the leadership really matters because those are people who are going to be able to impact the news cycle. Those are the people that are going to be able to kind of like hone and focus all the forces in one direction. And we've seen this on the left since the end of the Bernie campaign. Without one figure kind of like galvanizing everybody in one direction, it has kind of just devolved into a lot of infighting about what the right issues are and what's the right approach and what's the right strategy. And is this, are you problematic? Are you problematic? Who should be canceled? I mean, it really has turned into that, like who in this movement is even allowed to be in this movement or speak for this movement. So yeah, ultimately I think the leadership really, really does matter, which is part of, you know, it goes back to your question in the beginning, like, how are you feeling, Crystal? which is not great because there's not a, you know, there's not a clear successor and there's not a clear path. Now, what I kind of tell myself and what I think is true based on what we've seen is that the landscape is shifting so incredibly rapidly every single day that just because you don't see a clear path, like it doesn't really mean anything, or see a clear leader doesn't really mean anything. Before Bernie Sanders jumped into the 2016 race, like no one was thinking about that guy, you know, really running for president. So these things can emerge really quickly and forces can be galvanized really quickly. That's something that is different about the media landscape today. But I do ultimately think that the leaders end up being fairly determinative.
I'm really glad you articulated the sort of problem of the hyper-nationalization of politics. It's something that I'm really sort of concerned with, but not in a sort of annoying, like Ben Sasse way, but like actually, like this is like a huge operational problem that you can't have a, like you said, a Kentucky Democrat would probably be a little more socially conservative than a sort of like a Democrat from Oregon where I'm from, or a Democrat from, you know, New York or something. So that's a huge issue. But the question then is, and this is also acknowledging your point that we can't always see the path, like directionally though, what do you think would be the tactic for sort of forcing back against that? Because from my perspective, the hyper-nationalization of politics basically helps sort of both parties' establishment in the sense that the more every race is about who you're going to appoint to the Supreme Court, the more this is sort of about insert culture war issue of the week, unless it has to be about actually changing the orientation of best parties to be more reflective of sort of the better working class coalition thing we're interested in. How do you think about that structurally?
I don't know the answer to that, Marshall. I'm just going to be super honest with you because I think that's the conundrum. I think that's it exactly right there. Because right now it seems like the, you know, within the Democratic Party, like the neoliberals have basically won. And at the moment when the left had the most potential power, right, before Bernie drops out of the race, when they need him to fall in line, when they need him to say, okay, guys, come on, we got to get in behind Joe Biden, like he asked for nothing. And all of the left organizations also say, look, we're going to push you on these things, but really you have our votes already. That's the moment when you have political leverage and power, like this idea. And look, I mean, I'm going to do my best as well. But this idea that once you have a Biden administration, that's when you can really start to push him. It's ultimately a fantasy. And the reason, and this isn't the first time that we've seen this dynamic play out, because ultimately our politics has become an existential battle. This is what, and this is what terrifies me. I mean, truly terrifies me. Liberals believe Donald Trump is literally Hitler. Literally Hitler. And I understand why they believe that, because number one, it gives them some fodder for that. But number two, they've been fed a steady media diet of that for 4 years. And so if you're like, this guy is literally Hitler, then yeah, your like grievances about Joe Biden seem pretty stupid and like inappropriate to level at this moment. So when you create this existential politics where if the other side wins, like this is literally the end of democracy. That is how it is seen. This is literally the end of democracy. And by the way, you hear that rhetoric on the right too. I'm not sure that it's quite landing because Joe Biden is so, like, you know, hard to kind of characterize in that way. Yeah. I'm not sure the right is really fully bought into this is literally Hitler, Joe Biden. But that's the type of existential politics that we exist within. And so when that is the case, yeah, there all of your policy differences, all of your concerns about the trajectory of the party become sort of null and void because you got to just do whatever you can to keep literal Hitler from getting reelected. And we don't have time to like hear your concerns about, oh, the working class is struggling. We don't care. We just have to get this guy out of office. That's the trap. And it's the trap this time around. It was the trap with Bush. It's always where we end up. And I'm not sure how you get out of it ultimately.
I think it's, and I completely agree. It's just, what's crazy to me is that I sometimes try to think about this mentally as you bracket the existing political conundrums that we have. Hypernationalization of politics, MSNBC, Fox News, and, you know, the current party establishments. But then at the same time, like you said, you've got Rhode Island. We've got, you know, I mean, your and I show has exploded. You got a guy like Joe Rogan, who now the president is talking about. You see this massive influx of people into new media, into independent streams, and more. And we shouldn't overstate that power, but we shouldn't understate it either. What does that mean, kind of in the context of all of this? Because for every time, you know, as many boomers who are out there getting brainwashed by MSNBC, there are millennials who are watching you and me, or they're listening to this podcast, or listening to Joe Rogan's podcast, and all this. I mean, is that a hopeful thing? Is it more balancing than we should think? What do you think about that?
I think it's a piece of information about how, about the distance between elite rule and the desires of the public.
Yeah.
And anytime you have that distance, it creates opportunity, it creates tension. It can explode in productive ways, it can explode in deeply destructive and frightening ways, right? So to me, it's a piece of information about a possibility that exists, but in what way is that possibility ultimately expressed? And is it a way that moves us forward or sort of rips the country apart? That part I don't really know, which is why, you know, and this is kind of hokey and like, I mean it in a kind of hokey way, like part of why I find what you guys are doing so important, part of why I'm, you know, really proud of what we do on Rising is because we have to believe that our fellow citizens are like basically decent human beings and who may have a hot take, right? Yeah. It's controversial to say because all of the incentives in traditional media and in our political economy are like to paint the not just the politicians on the other side, but the voters on the other side as actually evil actors who want to destroy you and your family in the country and all of those things. And like, this country can't survive. We can't survive that way. So the fact that there's an appetite for that conversation, for that sort of, you know, discussion that's focused on, okay, a belief, a faith in the basic decency of people in the country is hopeful to me and is a piece of information as well. I think the other thing that I would say here is that in terms of a path forward, to the extent that there are any like real things I would say that number one are hopeful and number two we need to do, the fact that young Americans have a very different type of politics than older generations, like basically millennial down, has a very different way of thinking about politics and engaging with politics. That's a potentially hopeful thing. The other piece that I would say is, I think any sort of populist economic movement has to have at its core a re-energized labor movement.
Yes.
And there's been a lot of research around, and I really appreciate Sagar, by the way, you having like, you know, a heterodox view on this on the right. There's been a lot of research around, you know, this is one of the only places where working class people of different races engage. And it reduces racial discrimination. It reduces like this hyper partisanship. It's actually a really good thing for society. a healthy labor movement. And for people who are like skeptical of big government or whatever, I mean, this is like a way for workers in their own workplace and communities and towns to have and exercise power and form coalitions and do so in a way that's like real and engaging with other human beings, not some like bullshit Twitter conversation. Mm-hmm. So for me, a reinvigorated labor movement is probably an essential part of a better ultimately politics for in terms of working class people.
So speaking of Rogan, I want you to put on three different hats here. Hat one is you've been on Rogan. Hat two is you've been a candidate. And hat three, like you're a political commentator.
Yeah.
Should or shouldn't Joe Biden go on Joe Rogan? Right, and I, at a very meta level too, right? Because I was sort of annoyed at some of the sort of takes where people were like, oh, Dementia Joe would never go on the show, which actually Joe put in a request to go on the show during the primary. So it's actually a little sort of complicated. But how should candidates, especially center right, center left candidates, think of this sort of new media thing? Because obviously Trump, I think, in a weird way would do well on Rogan, but I'm not really sure what Biden to sort of do. So what do you just think about that?
It's an interesting question because the like the strategy piece and the like good for the public piece are kind of at odds. because from the strategy perspective, I can't really argue with their strategy of like really picking and choosing the Biden, you know, Joe Biden spots in terms of who he sits with and what the setting is and how much control they have over it. I can't really say that that's been the wrong political strategy. They're betting on not paying any political price for not taking more questions and not being more accessible. And I think they're probably right about that bet. In terms of like American public and the quality of the discourse, it's deeply sad that that kind of a freewheeling conversation would be something that, you know, that the Democratic Party, but I mean, both parties in general would like not be really comfortable with and not really want. Like Trump can't resist the media. He can't, it's not like he has good intentions here. He just can't resist the spotlight. His ego needs it. I mean, he knows he shouldn't be talking to Bob Woodward 19 times, but he just can't help himself doing it. So like, that's where it comes from. It's not like any sort of benevolent, like I really want to inform the American public here, right? Right. Yeah, let's be clear about that. But
I believe in transparency, people.
Right, exactly. But, you know, this has been, and this gets back to the point about this being like an existential choice now. It's been such a substance-free election, certainly the most substance-free election I can remember and potentially in American history in terms of policy and plans. Nobody has any clue what either of these candidates would do if they actually get elected. And it doesn't really matter to them because all they need to know is that it's not the other team. That's it.
Yep.
So when you have an existential election like that, any sort of policy or plans or vision ends up going by the wayside. The debates don't matter. Even if they went on Joe Rogan for 4 hours and, you know, I'm sure it would be a fascinating exchange. People would be excited about it. They would listen to it. Would it ultimately make a difference in terms of electoral outcomes? Very unlikely.
So that's actually the part that bothers me most, Crystal, which is that, I mean, we know this whenever we interview Congress, most of these people suck. I mean, most of these congressmen,
gloves
they don't
off,
know
Sager.
Anything. I'll say it. I don't care if they I know some of them even listen. Look, I mean, most of them are uninteresting. You know, they couldn't survive 3 hours on Rogan. They don't have 3 hours worth of thoughts. I mean, a lot of them are just people who are like anodyne, inoffensive to a party establishment. And that's why they get chosen to go in the first place. And then per what we were talking about earlier in terms of the Nate Silver analysis, which is that a recent regression, just for everybody's awareness here, and we can throw it up in the show notes or something, which is that now candidate dynamism, like the difference in a candidate, does not matter. Raw partisanship is actually the most predictive outcome of your election or not. And so that is actually what I think depresses me more, is that we live in this hyper-nationalized age, but the type of system that has evolved in order to churn out these politicians who come out on the national stage is not necessarily a great one. Like we don't have like some pretty inspiring people. But what I want your thoughts on, Crystal.
You might say they're not sending their best, Sagar.
They are not sending their best. But the left was the first to break this model. And I haven't seen it yet on the right. I think largely because the right is still more controlled by the establishment. AOC, the Justice Democrats, they're the ones that came up with that model. And since you've been involved with this world, could you tell us like the intellectual genesis of Where did it come from that people were like, you know what? Fuck this. We're going to run AOC. We're going to run a Cori Bush. We're going to run a Rashida Tlaib who come to DC. And look, I mean, we've criticized them plenty on the show. Like, they're not like the great revolutionaries as sometimes say they are. But I mean, they're better than nothing if you're a leftist. And we don't really have the same corollary on the right. So where did it come from?
Well, I think part of why that model has been able to succeed is because of the changing landscape around money and politics. So the positive thing that has happened, and this started with Obama and I think is more fully developed on the left, which is part of why this movement is possible on the left and not so much possible on the right, is because you do have this massive army of grassroots donors who will kick in their small dollar contributions and give you enough money to be able to compete. So AOC was massively out fundraise announcement, but she had enough to be able to get the message out and be able to make some waves. She, of course, is uniquely talented in terms of like capturing media attention and capturing social media attention, really was like native to that and understood that, so that she was able to amplify her dollars as well. And so I really think that's the piece that has changed the dynamic, where now you don't, there is an alternative model to having to go and suck up to all of these same donor types that exist within the regular party establishment. I mean, when I ran for Congress in 2010, this is very early days for this. There wasn't that same like national grassroots fundraising base established. And so I literally called every single Obama donor over $1,000 in the entire country to try to raise money for my campaign. Like it was painful. I did not know any rich people. Okay. Mm-hmm. So to cobble together that money, like, and that means those are the people you're talking to. That means those are the people you're making promises to. That means that's who you're beholden to. That's where your power comes from, if you're having to operate within that model. So now there's an alternative source of power, and there's an alternative model that's available to you. And so that is one of the most promising and hopeful things on the left. And it's a lot harder. This is where just like pure human nature comes in. When you're basically just AOC and the squad, right? Rashida and Ilhan and Ayanna, who is a little bit more of an Elizabeth Warren type. But when you're just those few people, it's really hard to resist the siren song of like Nancy Pelosi's mama bear and this is our team and all of those things. The more that you build, the strength in numbers is a real thing, because then you have a coalition, then you have sort of like just psychological comfort in knowing that you've got this group of people behind you. So I'm really interested to see if there's a little bit more of a radicalizing dynamic of now this time around, you're going to have the squad, you're going to have Jamal Bowman, you're going to have Mondaire Jones, you're going to have Cori Bush. She's the one I'm really particularly excited about. She's got a lot of fierceness to her. And I mean, real like working class story, been homeless, lived all of that, is very close to all of that. So, but yeah, I think that's where the model really came, where the possibility for the model came from, was this alternative potential source of power and funds outside of the traditional Democratic establishment donors.
Yeah. Well, Quick pushback, Sagar, and this actually takes us back to 2010, which is that I don't think the left could claim an exclusive sort of mantle on like primarying people, because that's what the whole Tea Party thing was.
Right.
Right. And because that's actually the critical sort of difference. This is us like showing.
I guess I'm
like,
just trying to whitewash it because I want to black out whatever happened.
Well, yeah, because that's actually
all we have are Justin Amash in Congress.
Well, yeah, but that's a real thing. And I think, and this is what I want to sort of know about here, because look, the Tea Party politically was incredibly successful, right? Overthrew a speaker, hobbled Speaker Ryan in many, so with the overthrew John Boehner, hobbled Speaker Ryan in many sort of ways, really sort of scared the sort of DC establishment. And then obviously that didn't go anywhere. We didn't repeal Obamacare, right? Like at the end of the day, the only thing that was delivered was sort of like tax cuts. Like whether you support that or not, like that was not the literal only thing that they were running on in 2010 and 2012 and 2014. But what I would just sort of say here though, is to me, it seems the reason why the Tea Party was more effective as a political movement in Congress was it was probably more reflective of like the GOP base, as in there were probably like a sort of
boomer, fiscally conservative, socially conservative, anti-Obama base in probably every single congressional district. But it's not quite clear that there's an actual like squad or Justice Democrat crew that could fit in more than a third of the districts in the country. So how should sort of like the progressive left, who's sort of looking at sort of how the Tea Party went down, how should they be thinking? Because I just don't think the, you know, squad policy agreement or not is as reflective of how actual Dem voters feel as the Tea Party was for GOP voters.
Yeah, that I agree with that. I mean, first of all, the Tea Party was a little more amorphous. I mean, it was partly like reaction to Obama. It was very reflective of this particular strain in the Republican Party, which is like the sort of small business merchant class, like very fiscally conservative, very like libertarian on that. And, you know, very socially conservative as well, of course, but they always frame themselves as like, no, we're just about like cutting spending. And if you're just about cutting spending, they're very effective at pushing politics to the right on those issues. But I don't know that that really is deeply reflective of the Republican base of the party. In fact, those, if you're talking about just fiscal austerity, in fact, the politicians in Washington, the Republican Party, are out of step with where a lot of the Republican base is. On the left, I think it really depends on what issues you're talking about, right? There's on economic issues, certainly the squad is very reflective of where the Democratic Party is on Medicare for All, even on Green New Deal, certainly on labor rights, on minimum wage, all those things, they're very much in line with the base of the Democratic Party. I think when you start talking about more social, when you start talking about more social issues is when you have a little bit of a split there and the politics are somewhat less popular among the Democratic base. So I do think there is an opportunity there. And one of the things that has been hopeful this time around is you've had some of the corporate behavior of the Democratic establishment actually put in a spotlight, and that corruption of the Democratic elites in the party put in the spotlight. Whereas it used to be there's no accountability for that. You could get away with, you know, selling out to big pharma and big whoever all day long, and no one in your district would ever hear about it. Now that is starting to change, and that could potentially force a little bit more of a shift in the party, a little more accountability. Ultimately, the biggest success of the Tea Party wasn't so much the individual primaries that were won. It was the fact that they scared the shit out of a lot of Republican incumbents.
Right.
Into supporting them and their priorities, ultimately legislatively. And that was extremely popular. Also remember, in any primary, the people who vote are like the most committed ideologues, right? The furthest right or the furthest left people. So it becomes a very real, threat, especially in deep blue districts. Like, your only real threat then is from your left. So if you have some pressure put there, you can start forcing people to move your way, which is kind of what happened ultimately with Ed Markey too here, where he's been a conventional liberal senator. And because of pressure from his own primary challenge, he's kind of moved himself to the left to align more with the squad, whereas previously it was just kind of like a normal liberal establishment type senator.
Right. And they ended up putting him over the edge, which is important in that competitive primary. I guess just to wrap this up.
His power to them now.
Exactly. And he can't forget that. I guess just to wrap, I mean, one of the things that we talk so much about, obviously on the show and here, is just like this declining faith in institutions. And I got to say, we covered a story this morning on Rising, which has really shaken me about this vaccine. And I think it encapsulates everything about where we are. And so just for context for the audience, like, this is Cal Cunningham. He's running in the Democratic seat for the United States Senate against Tom Tillis. He was asked in a debate whether he would take an FDA-approved vaccine, not like some hydroxychloroquine with the Trump stamp on it, like an FDA-approved...
Signed.
Like made in China, you know, Trump-branded hydroxychloroquine. That's not what we're talking about. It's like, we're talking about FDA-approved coronavirus vaccine. And he's like, you know what? I'd be hesitant to take it. And we cover that poll about how 51% only of Americans say that they would take a vaccine. And it struck me about how deeply people distrust the institutions in American life right now. I mean, how are you, Is there a way forward? And what are the consequences of that? Because that's just not about a vaccine. That is about the way you look at the country. That's about the way you think about elections. That's the way that you think about everything and your fellow citizens. What are the consequences here?
I mean, I don't want to be alarmist, but the consequences are as dire as they possibly could be. Like, you can't, you cannot have a country where everything is tribal. And we have literal armed clashes, not too frequent yet, but they're happening in the streets between rival political gangs. Everything from wearing a face mask to like sending your kids to school to taking a vaccine is becoming partisan and political and tribal. There is no path forward like that. I mean, there just isn't. And that's why I look at Election Day with, you know, deep trepidation. And I don't want to be alarmist here, but when you look at the fact that majority of Americans say that if their candidate doesn't win, they will view the election as rigged. It's actually like higher among Joe Biden supporters, 60 something percent say that if Trump wins, it's only because the election was illegitimate. So even the way we interpret election results now is like completely divided along partisan lines. Every institution, there's no one who is trusted, nothing that is trusted, nothing that is beyond where politics, you know, doesn't touch. Deep distrust between citizen, like citizen to citizen. I don't know what the answer is, but it's, if we continue in this direction, I mean, it's just not a sustainable track that we are on currently.
Yeah, I really think so.
I mean, this is even pushback, it's just sort of perspective, but I mean, I honestly don't know what I think about a vaccine. Like, I actually don't know if a vaccine sort of showed up. I mean, I would take it, I'm pretty sure, but I definitely just sort of, there's like a neuron ping of like saying like, would you really want to do this? It's basically sort of like, I'm not sure I want to be the first one to jump into this lifeboat.
Right.
If America is the Titanic right now, which isn't a great
metaphor.
Well,
that's metaphor, the thing, Marshall. We're not blaming you. We're not like, oh, you're an idiot for not taking the vaccine. I'm not just you. I'm saying anyone. I'm saying like, you're like, oh my God, like, this is now like an elite liberal thing. It's obviously Republicans are more likely in the data to say that they won't take a vaccine. It's like a 50-50 split. And I think what it is that the failure of the CDC, Trump's failure, really, in terms of taking care of the virus, has set us up to a point where, like, I think, Chris, you were talking about this with mask wearing. It's like, the moment mask wearing became politicized and the moment this stuff's become tribal, then it's kind of over in terms of broad public trust in institutions, which you're supposed to care a lot about. And I think that that is really the scariest part. And it's like you point to in terms of Election Day, like with 2/3 of Biden supporters say they won't accept it. 1/3 of Trump supporters, I think, said something similar, that you're in a situation where it's like, if you can't accept the legitimacy, then there's just no path forward. And I mean, one thing I think, Crystal, what we talked about was about how much damage that tribal media has kind of played into this. To me, and I'm curious what you think, it's, you have to believe in a conspiracy, because if you don't believe in a conspiracy, then you can't accede any legitimacy to what the other side believes. And I think that's what it's really all about for them.
Yeah. I mean, on the vaccination thing, and look, like, Trump has made all of this worse because he so nakedly injects politics and personal loyalty into literally everything, right? Every appointee is because they're loyal to me. Everyone, the metric of success is like, how slavishly have they, you know, have they backed me and fallen in line? He just is so naked about all of those things that he makes it all worse, so that it's not crazy when an educated person is like, oh, the vaccine that's coming out of the Trump administration, I'm not sure if I want to be the first one to sign that up. But yeah, then when you have all the incentives in elite media are to be completely tribal, completely partisan, to wherever Trump is, be on the other side, or if you're Fox News, wherever the Democrats are, be on the other side, without regard to any sort of facts or reality, you end up in this place. And I saw all kinds of elite journalists jumping in to defend Cal Cunningham and say, this isn't anti-vaxxer, this is completely like rational. And look, is there a world in which the vaccine is rushed into production in order to try to get in before Election Day? And I would say to people, you shouldn't take, yes, there is a world where that happens. But the point is, you have to wait for the facts before just assuming everything is a conspiracy or inventing a conspiracy. You have to stick to what the facts and the data actually show. And now in the Democratic Party, and I think to extend the Republican Party too, if you don't go all in on the conspiracy theories, then they think that you're like providing comfort to the enemy. You're not on the team. You don't support their values. I mean, you're just like kicked out of the silence altogether. So if you want to succeed, you're not only going to like back the latest conspiracy theory, but you're going to invent your own. That's how you really get to the top.
Yeah. So my last big picture question, it's sort of a recurring theme throughout this conversation, basically comes down to these broad themes we're talking about, sort of distrust in institutions, hyper-nationalization, various sort of infighting. Would a Trump re-election make things worse, keep them the same? Would a Biden victory make things better? Because this is sort of the big debate people are sort of having. Because if you're sort of, for example, a lot of Biden Republicans would basically say things like, well, look, I think that Trump is sort of the issue. And I may disagree with sort of the radical left, but he ultimately is someone who inflames these things. You could be someone who says, yeah, it's bad right now that half of Americans will literally not take a vaccine because Trump says it. Then the other half won't wear a mask until Trump wears a mask. But like... how are we sort of on this like set trajectory, or is sort of the personalities who's in power, will that change that at all?
Okay, so here's what I would say. Two things. Number one, I do think that Biden, just by temperament, like on the vaccine thing, he had a very good answer. He was like, yeah, I would take it tomorrow, but I understand, like, and Trump is doing this stuff and it's not good. But I would take a vaccine tomorrow, and we need to do that. I do think by temperament, he will help calm. People don't find him super scary. He uses normal, like standard issue presidential language about unity, about us coming together as Americans. It's not a, look, I'm not going to oversell it here, but I do think it would turn the temperature down a little bit. And here's the other thing, and maybe, you know, it's not fair to use this as like a selling point, but I don't think liberals are psychologically prepared for Trump to get reelected. Like, if he gets reelected, I really think, I mean, there is a lot of the country that is going to completely melt down. Again, they literally think that he is Hitler. So if Hitler gets reelected, what does that justify, right? What sort of actions are ultimately justified in that eventuality? I mean, not that I think things are going to be all cool and calm and collected if Biden gets elected. Trump, after Mitt Romney lost, called for a revolution. So like literally on Twitter, called for a revolution. So like if he loses, what do you think he's going to say? And his armed supporters, God knows what they will do. So I'm not saying that that's like a panacea either, but you know, I'm hopeful that maybe at least a little bit of calmer, more standard issue rhetoric out of the White House may at least turn the temperature down a couple degrees. That is my hope. Do I have like 100% confidence in that? Not at all.
I've been trying not to be a doomer, but I don't know how not to be. So, Crystal.
Me too. I keep trying to talk myself out of it, but here we are.
It's not working, sounds like.
This has
been a total failure of this episode.
Thank you so much for doing this, Crystal. We appreciate
it. My pleasure.
So much.
Thanks, you guys. Crystal. Thank you.
Boom.
Awesome. Thank you.
Hope you guys enjoyed the episode. Be sure to subscribe, send this to your friends and family, and rate us 5 stars on Apple Podcasts.
And as always, a special shout out and thank you to our sponsor, the Lincoln Network, for letting us do the work that we do here today. We will see you guys next week.